We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hi, everyone. It's Michael Nesmith on the Pantheon Podcast.
Rhiannon Giddens is her name. Not exactly household, yet, but she's pretty well known to aficionados of traditional folk and country music, music that falls under the generic umbrella of Americana. Rhiannon calls it string band music. She doesn't have much use for genres or labels. She puts it this way: tradition is a guide, not a jailer. In that same interview on National Public Radio, she reminded listeners that banjo music was invented by enslaved Africans in the Caribbean and North America. Born in 1977 in Greensboro, North Carolina, Rhiannon is multiracial. Her father is of European ancestry, while her mom has African-American and Native American roots. She was a remarkable kid, honor student in high school. She excelled in math and science. Rhiannon went on to Oberlin College, where she studied opera, graduating with honors in 2000. In 2017, Rhiannon Giddens received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. The award cites her work reclaiming the contributions of Black individuals in country and folk music. Rhiannon plays multiple instruments, most notably banjo and fiddle. She's founding member and lead singer for an all-Black string band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. The Drops have 7 albums out, and they bagged a Grammy in 2011 for Best Folk Music Album. That cut we opened with, Hit 'Em Up Style, is one of their better-known songs. It's an absolute hoot, a bluegrass reimagining of Blue Cantrell's R&B hit from 2001. Ms. Giddens also has 5 superb solo albums out. Michael Abels and Rhiannon Giddens won a Pulitzer Prize in music last year for an opera they composed together called Omar. She's also written music for film and ballet. On her solo records, she's collaborated with the likes of T-Bone Burnett, Jason Isbell, and Elvis Costello. This is one impressive individual. Even if you haven't heard of her before now, you've probably heard Rhiannon Giddens play the banjo. You probably heard her playing very recently, maybe even today. Her distinctive virtuoso banjo and viola decorate what is, as we write this, the number one song on the Billboard Hot Country charts. This new song has absolutely exploded across all the social media platforms, too. Not at all a stretch to call it the most played and most talked about piece of music on the entire planet right now, Beyoncé's new single, Texas Hold'em.
This ain't Texas.
It's one of 2 songs Beyoncé released on Super Bowl Sunday. The other one is called 16 Carriages. They'll inhabit her next album, which might be titled Renaissance Act 2, but that's just speculation. It's scheduled for release in late March. Beyoncé confirmed it will be a country album, and that's about all anyone really knows about it right now. We're looking forward to it. Given Beyoncé's track record, this will be her 8th studio album, and she hasn't made a bad one yet. And given that people like Rhiannon Giddens are a part of this project, pretty good chance the next Beyoncé release is gonna kill. Can't wait.
Sometimes 16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride with my dreams away to the summer sunset on a holy night on a long black road. All the tears I fight. 16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride.
This podcast is intended to be education and commentary. It will discuss adult themes and may use coarse language. Pantheon Podcasts presents Rock and Roll Archaeology with host Christian Swain. Music. Culture. Technology. And rock and roll. And now, on with the show.
Hey, diggers, Christian Swain here. Hey, I've got my 10-gallon big old hat on today. We're doing another Rock and Roll Archaeology short right here on the Pantheon Podcast Network. A little about country, a little about soul, and a little about how they're really all just the same darn thing. This short ties in pretty strongly with Chapter 5 of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Big Show, The Ballad of Bob and J.R. We're actually kind of proud of that one, so if you want to go back and listen to it again, that would not bother us, not one bit. All of our shows are at rockandrollarchaeology.com. Just hit the link that says listen, and it'll take you right to them. No, or you can find it on your favorite podcast listening app. Don't forget the support link. For as little as $1 a month, you can help us research, write, and produce more of these. All our Patreon friends get early access to ad-free episodes, and we do regular drawings for free books, posters, and other rock and roll swag, so keep an eye out for that. Richard blogs on Medium, and our own Jerry Danielson has gone Hollywood. He's currently working on a film score. We'll keep you updated on that as it becomes widely available. We're big fans of the incredible online archive called Rock's Back Pages, a great resource for all you rock and roll archaeologists out there in podcast land. That's rocksbackpages.com. All right, next up, we're seeing a nice little uptick in the social media activity, and we thank all of you for that. The Facebook group is starting to pop, so invite friends and family, like-minded folks you might know from online, so we can keep this rolling. More is more. Okay, now a little setup for this episode. In the year 2023, according to Inside Radio, country songs constituted 25% of the tracks featured on the Hot 100. That list takes in online streaming and terrestrial radio. Country music surpassed adult-oriented rock, or AOR, a couple of years back. Last year, it passed up hip-hop in terms of aggregate chart popularity. This trend is persisting into the year 2024. Country music is now second only to pure pop. Now, this is all marketing stuff. You know, labels and genres are just artificial constructs. We'll have more to say about this towards the end of the podcast. What's really going on is much more complex and much more interesting than these oversimplified aggregate numbers. But there is something here, and we're confident about that. Country music is on the upswing. More folks of all ages are streaming it and buying tickets. And there is an exciting new generation of country artists who are very loudly and very deliberately working outside the Nashville pop country establishment. New stars like Tyler Childers, Sturgill Simpson, and Molly Tuttle. Dozens of lesser-known but equally good country and folk acts. New faces and some old favorites coming back to their true roots. It's been labeled the alt-country revolt, and we are all in for it. So we thought it might be interesting to look at the changing face of country music and how we got here. And we're not really surprised that a big pop soul star like Beyoncé, who grew up in Texas, immersed in rodeo culture and Zydeco music, is about to drop a country album. So let's discuss. Friends, here goes another R&RA short, and we're calling this one Celebrating Country Soul.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Well, things have been a little complicated. Quality life has got me down. Well, sex is cheap and the talk is overrated. And the boys and me still working on the sound.
Since the beginning of the U.S. recording business in the early 1900s, industry leaders created and policed what Carl Hagstrom Miller calls a, quote, musical color line. This musical color line paralleled the rise of Jim Crow segregation. During this period, white Southerners were labeled hillbilly or old time, regardless of their musical influences, while black Southerners of all stylistic stripes got clumped together under the category of race music. Country and soul were the direct descendants of these two genres.
That's Professor Charles Hughes of Rhodes College in Memphis. Going all the way back to episode 4 of our main show, we've leaned heavily on the good professor's 2015 book, Country Soul, Making Music and Making Race in the American South. We even swiped a part of the title for this short. Country Soul really is a must-read. We cannot recommend it enough. A quick aside here, country music evolved from European folk music and traditions, in particular Celtic music brought over by America's poor white immigrants. That's a commonly told story. That's not wrong, but it's not the whole story either. African influences are very much a part of the mix, and have been from the very beginning. And that part of the story needs to be told more. Rhiannon Giddens, the terrific musician we profiled in the opening segment, embodies this blend of traditions. Back to Country Soul. While laying out some of the history, Professor Hughes argues, very persuasively, that all through the 20th century and well into this century, record companies and broadcasters racially segregated country and soul. They were marketed and sold as distinct and mostly incompatible genres. But in reality, they are tightly intertwined traditions that have always borrowed heavily from each other. And many of the practitioners, the working musicians who actually made the records, moved easily between the two. They recorded soul music in Memphis and Muscle Shoals, threw their gear in the trunk, and drove a few hours to Nashville to play on country records. It was all the same stuff to them. File that idea away. We're going to come back to it.
Well, the folk scene's dead, but he's holding out in the village. He's been writing songs, speaking out against wealth and privilege. He says, I don't believe in money, but a man could make him a killing. 'Cause some of that stuff don't sound much different than Dylan. I hear down there, it's changed, you see. Well, they're not as backward as they used to be. He's gone country. Look at them boots. He's gone country.
In the mid-90s, country music hit a new peak of popularity in America. At its highest point, around 70 million people, suburban moms, college-educated professionals, even teenagers, would tune into country music radio each day. The charts were ruled by ruggedly handsome, video-friendly guitar slingers in tight jeans and cowboy boots. They were called hat acts, as in big hat, no cattle. The women performers, think Shania Twain or Faith Hill, were sexy but wholesome divas with big arena rock voices that reached all the way out to the cheap seats. They blended charming tales of county fairs, pickup trucks, and achy-breaky hearts with rock and roll production values. Many of the big hits from that era were churned out by teams of professional songwriters working on Nashville's Music Row. Throw in some fiddle and pedal steel decorated with a Telecaster solo played by a Nashville cat. Radio programmers dubbed it Hot Country, and audiences ate it up. Even in city slicker markets like L.A. and New York, country music radio surpassed rock and hip-hop programming. CD and concert ticket sales kept pace. lots of rock and pop musicians decided to get in on the action and put out country-flavored material. A lot of it was clout chasing, calculated and phony, and it sounded that way. And some of that 90s country was really good. We especially like the neo-traditional country music. That stuff was happening in the 90s. Records with a little mud on the tires that also managed to be crafty and polished. I think Lyle Lovett and Dwight Yoakam, they put out really fine albums in those years. Lucinda Williams, the same. That was also when the legend herself, Dolly Parton, left L.A. and went back to Tennessee. She then put out some of her best music yet. Throw out a couple more examples. The Chicks' first release on a major label was in 1995. The Mavericks had like a dozen hit singles all through the 90s. They were everywhere and are still great. Then came September 11th, 2001.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this dark night. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half mile of line. Come on up for the rising.
The Rising was Bruce Springsteen's empathetic, prayerful response to the grief and horror of that day. The song and the album resonated. It struck a clear, strong chord in the American psyche. The Rising went platinum many times over. It opened a new chapter in an already illustrious music career. Bruce took home a Song of the Year Grammy for The Rising, his second such award. And there was another kind of musical response to 9/11. It was crass, jingoistic, and deeply stupid, and mostly came from those same hat-act country singers who established themselves in the go-go years of the mid and late 90s. In the wake of 9/11, phony, performative patriotism co-opted country music. A lot of country artists, most of whom should have known better, jumped on that bandwagon. No, we're not going to play any examples, and we're not going to throw shade at any particular artist either. We'll just refer you back to one of our shorts, The Art of the Steal. It's linked in the show notes, or just go to our website. We discuss the intersection of right-wing politics and popular music in that one. Or the lack thereof, said intersection. Anyway, at about the two-thirds mark of that podcast, we talk about something called American Cringe. Pop country in the wake of 9/11 was American cringe. We dare say a new low for American cringe, the absolute nadir, the freaking Marianas Trench. Here's the good news. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction, right? It was a slow rolling thing and took over a decade to fully develop, but there was a response. We've seen it called the alt-country revolt in some publications, so we'll use that title for now. We think the Chicks fired the first shot of the alt-country revolt early on, way back in 2002, with this song.
Now me and Delia singing every Sunday, watching the children in the garden grow. We listen to the radio to hear what's cooking, but the music ain't got no soul. Now they sound tired, but they don't sound happy.
Long time gone.
They sound tired, but they don't sound haggard. They got money, but they don't have cash. Bullseye. The chicks called it out. This isn't authentic. This is counterfeit country. Don't fall for it. Long Time Gone was another big hit for the chicks, but it definitely offended some folks. And the chicks weren't done ruffling feathers. At the London stop of their Top of the World tour in March 2003, the chicks took a swing at then-President George W. Bush. Singer Natalie Maines, born and raised in Lubbock, said Bush made her feel ashamed to be a Texan and sharply criticized the impending Iraq invasion. Her bandmates Marty McGuire and Emily Strayer stood with her. Events proved the chicks right, but at the time, speaking out against American militarism was a good way to piss off a lot of people. And that's exactly what happened. Keep in mind that the chicks were touring the world behind their second multi-platinum album in a row. Their newest single, Traveling Soldier, was number one in the UK charts at that moment. They had a huge platform, and immediately, Natalie's remarks were everywhere. The backlash was swift and ferocious. Country stations blacklisted them. Hate mail and death threats poured in. Sales plummeted, shows were canceled, and corporate sponsorships evaporated. The whole story is vividly told in the 2006 documentary Shut Up and Sing, which we strongly recommend. It was 14 years before the chicks made another album, Gaslighter, released in 2020. They are still the biggest selling all-female band ever, and there are still venues that will not book them and radio stations that will not play them. We're going to argue something here. The chicks' integrity, their adherence to principle, and their willingness to take the consequences standing up that created a space for other artists to do the same. We recall a scene in the Taylor Swift documentary Miss Americana from 2020. Taylor is backstage, talking with her family and her PR team. They're trying to talk her out of being more outspoken. She basically replies, and we're paraphrasing here, "Look, I don't want to get Dixie chicked either, but I feel like I have to do this." We'll say it again. The chicks fired the first shot of the alt-country revolt.
I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could, cause I'm mad as hell. Can't bring myself to do what it is you think I should. I know.
She never raises her voice. She's just always calm. That was how Emily Strayer of the Chicks described rehearsing with Beyoncé. Beyoncé's latest single was a country song called Daddy Lessons. Off her new album Lemonade, she invited three of her fellow Texans, the Chicks, to perform it with her at the 2016 Country Music Awards. It was a stunning performance, blew the roof off the joint. Here's a piece of it, and we'll link the whole thing in the show notes.
Texas, Texas,
came into this world, daddy's little girl, but daddy made a soldier out of me, daddy made me dance, daddy held my hand, but daddy lifted the whiskey with his teeth.
Spectacular energy, talent, and artistry, but that 2016 showcase at the CMAs now seems like, even more than that, an inflection point, an opening. It took another 8 years, but now, for the first time, a song by a black woman sits at the top of the country charts.
The relationship between country and soul was the South and the United States in microcosm.
So, let's wrap it back around to the beginning with the help of Professor Hughes. We took note of an undeniable historic truth. Country music and soul music are deeply intertwined. They spring from the same traditions, the same culture, They are the same traditions, the same culture. Any perceived barrier or difference between genres, all those classifications and terms like country and soul and bluegrass and rock and roll, are artificial constructs that stem from marketing decisions. Decisions often based on racist assumptions. Decisions made to culturally enforced bias and separation. Gatekeeping. Just more gatekeeping. We use those terms and classifications, some ourselves, but only as a loose shorthand, a convenient way of talking about music and audiences. That is their only utility, all that they are good for. They don't actually mean anything. Crossing those boundaries, or better yet, ignoring them completely, that's what great artists do. That's where the excitement comes from. That's where we get the originality. So, Lyle Lovett and Sturgill Simpson perform with horn sections and tinge their music with black gospel. And now Beyoncé's putting out a hotly anticipated country album. Rhiannon Giddens is reclaiming bluegrass for its African-American founders. And why wouldn't they? It's all the same stuff. All part of the same fabric. The universal sound.
Pocahontas in the cranberry glades. Ain't got bars nor the charge to call her anyways. My mind's a mile a minute and my thoughts to bark like hounds. I focus on my breathing and the universal sound.
I'm Christian Swain, and this has been Rock and Roll Archaeology on the Pantheon Podcast Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Y'all keep up the rockin' now, here.
Rock and Roll Archaeology is written by Richard Evans and Christian Swain. Produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Jerry Danielson at Busy Signal Studios. Find all of our shows, notes, and links at pantheonpodcast.com. All songs can be found for purchase or streaming wherever you get your great music. Please pick up these amazing tracks. Contact us on social at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods.